All right, so let's go to James chapter 2. Last time, a couple of weeks ago, we were looking at the first seven verses. I won't go back and reread those, but just as we look at those, what's the overall topic he's dealing with, the sin he's dealing with here?
Partiality.
And this is a temptation for all of us, even today, is this sense of regarding one person over another because of the way they look, how they're dressed, right? Because of, whatever factor you want to put in the blank, right? And so James is condemning that kind of behavior, that's not what we should be doing. He notes here that you have a rich man with fine apparel and gold rings coming into the assembly. And then he contrasts that man with the poor man who comes in shabby clothes. And so he's asking the question to us is, how do you handle that situation? Do you show regard for the person who's dressed well, the person who's maybe affluent and wealthy? And show disregard to the one who isn't dressed as well, who maybe doesn't have as much money, who may be poor. It's interesting he describes them this way. One of the things about the gold rings, the ring was a symbol of wealth during that time. I was reading where they would even rent, if you will, rings to put on their fingers so that if they wanted to go out and impress somebody to demonstrate that they're maybe wealthier than they are, they might even rent a piece of jewelry for a little while in order to make a good impression. And so he's not just randomly talking about gold rings. That was something that for those people, that ring noted something for them. And so they would wear multiple rings on their fingers in order to demonstrate their wealth. Think about today, like, how do people demonstrate their wealth now? Like, what are the objects or the items we use to say, look at how wealthy I am? Do we have any of those? Expensive cars, and cars are expensive, and they're getting more expensive. But yes, driving the particular kind of car, it's interesting. Sometimes you will see someone living in a house that maybe is in disrepair, but have a brand new car out in the driveway, right? And you question, Is that a good financial decision? I don't know. That's up between them and God. But we do prize cars. What other things do we demonstrate a sense of wealth?
Expensive homes,
where we live. Not just the home, but even the neighborhood we live in. Right? Certain neighborhoods are more prestigious than others, and you want to get here. You want to be a part of this community.
Especially if you've got them under extremely wealthy. They're not going to live in an average modest home. They're going to live in a multi-million-dollar home, and they're going to flaunt that wealth with that home.
Yeah, and that's a real temptation. Vince, you might turn on the fans. I'm a little warm. I don't know if y'all are, but I'm a little stuffy. Dwayne?
No, I was just going to say, to a certain extent, jewelry is still a sign. Yeah. I mean, you don't see it like you used to, but there are still people that, they have rings on 7 of their 10 fingers and all that stuff.
Think about a couple getting engaged, right? One of the things people want to know, how big of a diamond did you get, right? That's a demonstration of wealth. Why in particular this partiality toward the rich might be a temptation for churches to get into? Why does James in particular hammer this showing regard for a person's wealth over another person. What's the temptation for us as churches?
Why would attention to the rich person and the poor person, and not that that is always, you know, super bad thing to do is to pay attention to them, but if you lean toward them versus lean toward some of your poor people that attend church, then you're not treating everybody equally like you're supposed to.
Okay. Want to add to that? Why would that be a temptation for us as a church, as a congregation in the Lord's church, to do that kind of thing? Yes, ma'am.
I think the illusion is that they will give more money, and the church always needs more money.
Yeah.
For all kinds of reasons, but I think if we court those that are, you know, rich, they'll be more apt to give more money. But it's usually not the case.
Yeah. And but that's a real temptation. If you're an eldership, you're deacons, you're a minister, you're a member, right? And you know, you look over at the budget thing and not hitting the mark, and here comes in somebody who looks like maybe they could help that out. You might have a tendency to run over to them and welcome them and be really kind and good. And again, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's when you show the part, when at the same time you have a poor person come in and you're like, you don't show them the same kind of regard. You made yourself a judge of people. What's the illogical nature of that, though? There is an irrationality to that kind of thinking as Christians. What I'm going to take a guess at what that is. Why is that attitude irrational as Christians?
That's not how God looks at
people. Okay, it's not how God looks at people, right? What did he say when he selected David? He told Samuel, don't look at the exterior. Look, I'm looking at the heart of the person. What else makes that irrational? Who are the people more receptive to the gospel in general? And we're talking in general. I know there might be specific examples where you have a really wealthy person who's very responsive to the gospel. But in general, is that which one of those two people is generally more apt to be taught the gospel? It is. And What is our job as Christians? One of the main missions we've been given is to go out with the gospel. And so when we show disregard for the poor person, that's not to say we disregard the rich. We just don't demonstrate more regard toward the rich man than we do the poor. And so we see this over and over again throughout Scripture. All right. I'm going to get up and do jumping jacks or something. Get that mind flowing tonight. So he spends quite a bit of time in this section talking about or this contrast between how people show regard for one over another. In verse 6, he says that when you do this, what have you done? When you show partiality toward the rich and you ignore the poor, what have you done ultimately to the poor man?
Dishonored him.
Dishonored him. How are we showing him dishonor?
Because you're just not as nice to him as you are, as you should okay. be. I mean, people are people. You know, if you make $1 million a year or you make $20,000 a year, people are still people. You shouldn't treat them any different because of that.
And we've made a valuation on their soul. We have weighed it in our scales, and we've said this person's soul is just more valuable than yours. And so I'm going to go out of my way to go over here and to welcome this person warmly, but, you know, you're not as valuable to us. If you want to come on in, but yeah, you sit over there. You stand over there in that corner. We've shown him dishonor, disregard. We've disregarded his worth. And then he goes on to say, are not the rich ones the ones who oppress you and those who drag you into the courts? In James's day, this is a real kind of deal for them. Who were the ones who oppressed the early church? Was it the poor? No, it wasn't, right? Who did the oppressing? You think about the Pharisees, the Sadducees, right? Those on the council. Think about Herod. We talked about him this morning in Bible class. Herod, he killed James, the brother of John, right? Had him killed. He's had others imprisoned. You think about the Romans and the heavy hand that they have toward different groups of people. It was the rich who had actually oppressed them. Another reason why this whole thing is illogical is you're actually lifting up your oppressors while pushing down those who are like you, right? And those who can be your comrades in all of this. He says, are they not the ones who blaspheme the honorable name by which you are called? Right, the rich, he's saying they've shown a lack of respect for Jesus. It's interesting here. He doesn't call Jesus by name. He says the name by which you are called. But it's obvious that would have to be Jesus that he's talking about here. And so it just doesn't make sense to do that, to have that kind of attitude where you show partiality toward one person over another because they're rich, wealthy, powerful. Any questions about the first seven? All right. Let's go into verse 8. He says, if you really fulfill the royal law, according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. You are doing well. But if you show partiality, you are committing sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. For whoever keeps the whole law but fails in one point has become guilty of it all. For he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not murder. If you do not commit adultery, but you do murder, you have become a transgressor of the law. So speak and so act, and those who will be judged under the law of liberty, for judgment is without mercy to the one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. So he begins this section in verse 8 by talking about the royal law. So what is the royal law? What law is he discussing here? That may be what it may appear at first to be. What's the problem with that particular conclusion? They're not under the law of Moses. What he's talking about cannot be the law of Moses because they're not Israelites at this point. They're Christians. And so James would not be commanding them to go back to the law of Moses. So then what is he talking about? Yeah, so Christ's law. And so he quotes here, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. What did Jesus have to say about that particular commandment? So that commandment, if you go back to Leviticus, Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 18, that's where Moses commanded us to love our neighbors. Did Jesus not command the same thing? But he took it a step further, didn't he? How did he take it a step further?
He broadened the definition of neighbor.
Okay, he broadened the definition of neighbor. I agree. How so? How did he broaden it? Do you remember the parable he taught that's really well known? I mean, people who aren't even members of the church probably have at least heard of this parable. Parable of the Good Samaritan. What is that parable all about? What's that? Everyone is our neighbor. And we should do good to all. Whoever our neighbor is, that's the person we should be striving to love and to care for. If you will, let's go to... Let's go to Matthew 22. Matthew 22 and verse 40. If you go back to, actually start at verse 34, you have this lawyer, the scribe, coming to test Jesus. He asked a question in verse 36. What's the question he asked?
Which is the great commandment?
Which is the great commandment of what law?
Moses.
Law of Moses, right? That's the law they're under. This is the time before the cross. And so Jesus is going to answer in respect to the Israelites. And what their view of the law should be. He responds in verse 37. He says, you shall what? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. So that he's saying that is the greatest commandment. That everything else stems down from that. Then he adds in verse 39, and a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. So he's directly pulling that from the law of Moses. And then he adds in verse 40, and he says, on these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets. The foundation of the Mosaic law, and I would dare say the foundation of the New Testament law, is this. It's to love God with all your being, and to love your neighbor. And so Jesus in his own ministry, reiterates that commandment from the law of Moses. And so you have James here taking what Jesus taught there and saying to us that we need to do what? We need to fulfill that. He says, you are doing well. Okay? But if you're showing partiality, there's a problem, isn't there? What's the problem? You're not fulfilling that law. You're not being obedient. And in verse 9, he says that if you show partiality, you have actually become what? A sinner. And you are convicted by the law of Christ as a transgressor. Now, John tells us that sin is law-breaking. As a Christian, when I violate commandments like you shall love your neighbor as yourself, I have violated the law of Christ, and I show myself to be a sinner. And so he goes on here to give us an illustration of this. Verse 10, he says that if we endeavor to keep the law, and that's what we're trying to do, right? Isn't that our goal, is to keep the law of Christ? Right? You can at least shake your heads. Yes, that's what we're supposed to be doing. And yet, do we pay particular attention to whether or not we're actually fulfilling what he's called us to do? He holds us to a lofty bar. That isn't easy to get over. And so he uses this illustration of adultery and murder. What does he say about these two things? First, did Jesus command to not murder? Did he? Yes, go back to Matthew chapter 6. Right? Or is it Matthew chapter 5, actually? Matthew chapter 5. Right? You've heard it said that you shall not murder. I tell you, don't even call your brother Raca, right, in that way. So he takes that commandment from the Old Testament, and he even goes further. He says it's important not only to not do the physical act of murdering, but you shouldn't even have that hate in your heart. So, yes, he said do not commit murder. Did he say do not commit adultery? Yeah, so both of those are part of the law of Christ, right? But he didn't just say do not commit adultery. What did he go on to say? Don't even look at a woman with lust in your heart. Don't seek that out with your eyes. And so Jesus said not to do both of those things. And so James here says, if you do not commit adultery, but you do murder, in essence, you've become guilty of all of the law, not just a part. And you're going to be held guilty of it. So, is there such a thing as a little sin, a light sin, and a heavy sin? Consequences may differ as far as physical consequences, but ultimately, spiritually, are the consequences any different? He says, no, they're not any different. And so, verse 12, he says that we are to so speak and act as those who are judged under the law of liberty. We are being held to a standard. At the same time, verse 13. What's the principle of verse 13 that we should take away?
Mercy. You have to be merciful.
We need to be gracious to one another and forgiving. In Matthew chapter 6, I think it's verse 14, what does Jesus say about forgiveness? But he goes on, right? What does he say at the end of it? Then you won't be forgiven. So he gives us a scenario, right? In Matthew 6, he says, if you forgive others their debts against you, you'll also be forgiven. However, if you choose not to offer forgiveness, then is God going to forgive you? No. And so we need to be people who attempt to show mercy, because that's what we want. We want forgiveness, not to be held under the strictures of the law. Any questions about 8 through 13? So let's go down to verse 14. So he's going to switch topics. See, nobody asked me, right? Nobody asked me where to put chapter breaks in. But if I was putting chapter breaks, I would have had a chapter break here, because this is really a new thought. But they didn't call me up and ask me. I'm still waiting for that phone call. I think it's a time change. It's just got everybody. I guess this is supposed to be later than it is, and it's dark outside. I'm trying to get y'all liven up a little bit for me. So as we move from 13 into 14, what does the topic now become? Yeah, that's right. So it's faith, right? He's going to go back to a discussion he had in chapter 1. So he introduced it in chapter 1, and now he comes back in chapter 2 To further explain, sorry, I lost my place here. Just went away. So if you go back to chapter 1, he has a lengthy discussion there too, but if you start at verse 19 and you go through verse number 25, you know, what's the principle of chapter 1 that we took away from that? What's the summary line of that text? Verse 22 really hones in on it, right? So he says that we need to be people who do what we've been called to do. Not that we hear it and believe it, yet don't do it, right? So faith means that there should be action to follow. And if there isn't action that follows, well, that's what we're going to get into in chapter 2. And so as he goes back here in verse 14, let's notice the first few verses. He says, What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? And so he begins by introducing a question, a thought-provoking question, about whether or not faith can save. If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, I think it's interesting, what is he doing right here from the previous section? Yeah, remember that poor person that you showed disregard for, you dishonored? Now he's going to say, I'm going to bring that person into the full light. I want you to examine them and how you should have responded. Okay, so if someone says he has faith but does not have works, can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warm and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. So he brings up kind of a ridiculous thing. You know that this person does not have food at home. You know they don't. You're aware of that. You know they don't have proper another set of clothes to change into. So what they're wearing, that's what they've got. How ridiculous would it be for us, and also how disrespectful would it be for us to say, go on, go have a good lunch. Be warm, be filled. Do you see how disrespectful that is? That you have not just ignored their problem, but what have you actually done for them? You've thrown it up into their face. I know you don't have clothes. And so you're making a joke of them. How is that loving your neighbor? It isn't. At least you shouldn't have thrown it in their face. But what we should really do as Christians is to extend some kind of help to that individual. And so he gives us in 17 the concluding thought here. The result of this, which I think is expert reasoning, the end result is, when we think about faith, faith must be what? Accompanied by works. There has to be something produced from us. We'll discuss this more next week, but I did want to share with you one thing he mentions in here, if I can find it. Okay, So it says, so stated, it's talking about the question Paul presents. Can that faith save him? This is what he says, and I like this. So stated as to require a negative answer. So Paul states that, realizing it's a rhetorical no, right? You know the answer is no, and everybody else does. He says this is a refutation of the heresy that men are saved by faith only. He goes on, he says, note that James did not allege any deficiency in the man's faith, thus assuming that his claim was honest, but making his denial of the man's salvation to rest on the absence of work. So he makes a statement here in just a minute in verse 18. He says, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. Ultimately, what is he saying? Is the only way to identify that person as having any kind of faith is they have to tell me. And if you have to tell me you have faith, what does that ultimately really mean?
You don't really have it.
We'll continue this thought there in verses 18 and following as he goes further into this idea of what is real Christian faith and what is the play between belief and works, because that's really what it comes down to. Yes, we have to believe, and yes, we have to do works. And we can only believe when we do works. And our works only account for anything when we believe. And so they're not opposites. They're not, against one another. But they actually work in conjunction. Again, thank you all for being here. We'll dismiss from this time of study. We'll come back in chapter 2, verse 18 next Sunday evening. And we'll continue on. As we close out our study for tonight, is there anyone who was not able to partake of the Lord's Supper this morning? I don't see anybody. All right, we'll close with a word of prayer, and then we'll be dismissed. Vance, do you mind closing us in a prayer?